here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Here we are, squeezing into the final hours of the month of January, sharing this blue moon, bright moon together with our evening under lamplight. Our medium is Cambridge 105 Radio, community radio in Cambridge, as if you didn't know. The radio station in Cambridge that offers, listen, it offers both authentic local voices, talent and news, and also a wider selection of different kinds of music and talk than any other station you'll find around here. Try out some of the other offerings. Browse around this website to see all that's going on. Cambridge105.co.uk. That's the medium. And the voice, well, this is me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, and this evening we're going to pick up on some of the ideas we've been examining lately and give them a 180-degree twist. We've been talking, you may recall, about the insights we gain from Ray Davies' paradoxical line, to be yourself, you have to put on an act. And that's all very well, but now I want to explore the other side. You may be being yourself and putting on an act, but what do I do in response? How do I, the listener, the audience of your act, how do I get to see or feel or interact with this self of yours, incarnated in this act you're putting on? There's lots to explore, lots to attend to here, so stick around. You are invited to attend. But wait, don't hold me to a tight focus on this topic. I have a feeling I'll be just wandering around in and out of themes and examples. But that's all right. I hope you'll agree. And then, of course, there's the music, which I'm pretty sure you'll find interesting or amusing or both. Last time, and the time before that too, we were speaking about the distinction between your true self and the role we are adopting, the act we are putting on, consciously putting on, knowing that what we are doing and what we are feeling at the moment is not our true self, but just the way our true self is performing at the moment. If we're not aware that we're putting on an act and we just go about the day identifying with what we're doing, then we're simply not in touch with our true self, but living in some kind of ego self that sees the world only as it impinges on us, never appreciating things for their own sake. You get the picture. Here, let's take an example or two. Just a simple everyday example. Let's take, say, a postman. If the postman is caught up in the ego self, then he's likely to be identifying himself with what he's doing, for better or worse. He will either be full of self-importance, I'm doing this very important job, keeping people in touch with the things they need to know about and bringing them the things they've ordered online, Or, as I've seen many times, he will be disgruntled, pissed off at the people who have to set the rounds for that week, angry that he's supposed to take on two people's job going through the village, resentful that he has had to abandon the reliable bicycle for the stupid pushcart. He sees all this as a personal affront, or at least a personal inconvenience, and let's not even talk about the pay he's getting. You know, one of our postmen said to me a few years ago, before I did this job, I was a manager at a small Sainsbury's, and I left there because I thought the higher management didn't know what they were doing. But compared to the post office, they were wizards. Poor thing. He's not going to be happy or content. He's not going to see other people, except perhaps as obstacles in his way, or as ears he can pour his complaints into. But actually, I found, and I do usually fall into conversation with the postman as I walk the dog around the village, I found that most postmen are not like that. Certainly, our current postman is not like that. Perhaps it's just being outdoors, walking around in all sorts of weather, and the weather doesn't seem to faze him for some reason. But he seems healthy in body and spirit. He doesn't seem to identify himself with his job. Delivering letters and packages is an act he's putting on. It does not define his true self, which somehow remains free and outgoing. So there's always a cheerful lilt to his voice, even when he's in a rush, and a bounce to his step. He can look me in the eye when we talk, and we don't have to talk only about things relating to him. Oh, sure, he's quite ready to complain about the postal system's inefficiencies, but it doesn't come across as a whinge. Do you see how there's something radically different between this person and the other who could not see beyond the job he was doing, who could not see it as only an act he was putting on? We need a little break now. I won't take us to Please, Mr. Postman, but instead to a more joyful, playful song by the Incredible String Band, one of Mike Herron's songs, he being the more playful of the duo. It's just called The Letter, and it expresses the joy of receiving a fan letter all the way from America. It's from the I Looked Up album. Attend.
I started rubbing my eyes when I heard the birds talk. Said, hey, Mr. Sleep, you're gonna have to take a walk, 'cause nothing has much power to make me rise as the postman bringing the morning surprise. Here it comes, you better believe me, here it comes. Too much I've got a letter, better get out of bed. That's what I said. Then I pulled the covers right up to my nose and thought, well, a letter might be for Rose, her mother. She writes very regularly, Mr. Postman, have you got a letter for me? Mr. Heron? Yes, I have. Says right here, yes, I have. Too much I've got a letter, and I said it with some joy. It came from Maria, Chicago, Illinois. And I never have met her, but she sounds sweet like a flower growing on the rubbish heap. She got a lot of things, oh, she gotta work out, but she's gonna make it, have no doubt. Neither is she. Oh no. Maria played that, brought your letter. Must have felt a little bit lighter. And the air hostess must have felt brighter, bringing your doctor, and it's you.
The postman here is not ego-centered, we must imagine, but is one willing actor in a whole cast of characters carrying out this operation of bringing the letter from Maria in Chicago, Illinois, all the way to Mike Herron in Britain. There's the aeroplane, too, and as he says, Maria, the plane that brought your letter must have felt a little bit lighter. The air hostess must have felt brighter, bringing your letter over the sea. And the pilot was your Orpheus, singing a song for you. Maria, I'm singing, hear me singing, I'll be your Orpheus too. The plane must have felt lighter, playing its part in this web of interaction, and the air hostess must have felt brighter because she was acting a part. Well, the part of... I'm not sure what part the air hostess had in conveying the letter, but... she was there anyway, a part of the flight. The pilot was your Orpheus, that great mythic singer who brought beautiful music not only to people, but also to the rocks, which responded to his vibrations. And so the pilot takes up the tune of the letter, and then Mike, too, will be her Orpheus and sing the song her letter brings. In fact, this very song is the song her letter brought. Maria is the one who puts on the act, who initiates the song, which then continues on the plane crossing the ocean and arrives via the postman at Mike's door. And then he attends to her act and continues the song, actually enhancing the life of the letter by writing, performing, and recording this song. Presumably, Maria's letter was no ego-driven thing, but a conscious act that brought out her true self, and this is what Mike is responding to. First of all, the response has to be in the right spirit, not the ego state of asking what's in it for me. Hey, a letter from America. I must be selling big over there. That's more money coming in. No, not that, but a state of joy, and even of joyful rhyming. Too much, he says in the hippie slang of the early 70s. Too much. I've got a letter, and I said it with some joy. It comes from Maria, Chicago, Illinois. Has Illinois been made to rhyme with joy before? But it's this joyful start of the engagement that makes things go right. We don't know what the letter said, but there are hints that Maria wrote in some kind of trouble. Perhaps she was having a tough time and wrote to say that one of the incredible string band songs helped her in her darkness. But Mike knows that whatever the trouble is, it's not her true self, but just something that's happening to her, some act she has to pass through. By the time you hear this song, he tells her, your troubles will be gone, and you'll be left with what's shining through your letter. You. That is her true self, of course. Now, to tell you the truth, I didn't expect to get this much out of the song, which came to my head just because it was about a postman delivering a letter. But as I attended to the song, these other aspects of our theme made themselves known, and I continued the song through this different medium. And you too, listening to the song and to my words, you too maybe pick up the musical dance here, and you pass it on in some way or other to someone else. I am your Orpheus singing to you, and then you turn around and become the Orpheus to someone else. Even if your Orpheus act consists only in smiling at the postman, or someone else, or in slyly dropping the expression too much into your next conversation. Too much, man, far out. This distinction between the true self and the act we put on is often clearer with people who wear some kind of uniform at work. The uniform belongs to the job, and they put on the uniform as a sign that they're putting on the role they perform in the job. The military is often a good example of this, since the uniforms are clearly designed and demarcated. You wear your rank on your shoulder or lapel. That, too, is just the role you're playing. And thus, there is a clear distinction between the person and the office that the person is taking on. My captain might be a real schmuck, but it is not my job to obey that schmuck. I am obeying the captain, the office that this schmuck is taking on. This can cause real dilemmas, of course, when my conscience, my inner self, resists the commands of a superior. The best military regulations leave room for the conscience to override the office, but this is never an easy dilemma to resolve. Maybe this reminds us that it's never an easy task to resolve any conflicts between any role we take on and the promptings of our true inner selves. But it's time now for another song. But what will fit in here at this point? Okay, this doesn't quite fit, but we can make it fit sure enough. It's a song about being drafted. Remember the draft? Being drafted into the army. Something very close to many Americans when the Monitors released the song in 1966. It's a kind of dialogue between the army, who are sending him his draft notice, couched in the cutesy false terms of greetings, this is Uncle Sam, and the poor guy who's receiving the letter and will now have to abandon whatever roles he's been playing in school, after school, with his girlfriend, with his mother and friends. You're in the army now, he's told, and there are new roles to learn, and not very pleasant, especially since there's a good chance he'll be sent to Vietnam. It's a sort of comic song, with the drill sergeant toward the end barking out orders. There's a right way, a wrong way, and there's my way. You'll do it my way. Come on, boy, on the double. Come on, march. Your mama's a long way away, boy, so stop your crying. But Richard Street's voice as the draftee is so poignant and helpless as he says goodbye to his old life that the song is no longer all that funny, but very touching. I suppose it's a pivotal song, shifting from the patriotic enthusiasm for serving the country in Vietnam to the awareness that such service was only serving the big shots and the little guy was just a vulnerable pawn in this game. And it's a Motown song, so we get the Funk Brothers doing the instrumentation. If you've heard the song before, well, here it is again. And if you've never heard it, you're in for a treat. Well, that was the Monitors with Greetings, open brackets. This is Uncle Sam, close brackets. Yes, and another Motown song with parentheses in the title. But now we've rather veered away from our focus this evening under lamplight. We've attended to the distinction between our true self and the act we put on, the roles we perform as part of our everyday life and our relationships with other people. But now we want to turn it around. Presumably, we'd prefer being in touch with another person's true self rather than just some ego-centered self, right? And that true self can express itself by consciously putting on an act and knowing it's an act, not identifying itself with the act. But what we see is just the act. How then do we move from the act back to the true self behind the act? Well, let's first look at the negative side. It's often easier to talk about that. What are we doing when we just attend to the act itself and not to the person putting on the act? We saw an example of this last time in Feste, the jester in Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, the character in the play most aware of the dynamics of role-playing. But as I said last time, Feste's roles do not reveal his true self because the people listening to him do not care about his true self. Partly this is a class issue. Duke Orsino, the Countess Olivia, Sir Toby Belch, even Viola are all from the privileged classes and look down on Feste. As they said about the culture George Bush came from, there are two kinds of people, us and the help. Feste is the help and doesn't count to them as a person. But there's more than this. These people expect to be entertained, and that's not just a class issue. Feste is only an entertainer to them. His value consists only in his ability to sing a good song to fit their mood or tell a few jokes to lift their spirits. And I suspect that a lot of the time we are concerned with other people only insofar as they can entertain us or stimulate us or provoke us. In other words, only in what they can do for us or to us. The stand-up comic, for instance. We just want some laughs, and maybe if it's a quasi-political act, we also want some confirmation of our own political position. We're not really interested in connecting to the stand-up's true self. And even if he or she is a celebrity and has the private life plastered in the magazines, we're not nearer to the true self, but are seeing only the hype, either what the agent wants us to see or what the papers want to make the story about. And in a way, this cheapens us, since we put ourselves at the mercy of that stand-up who will play to the lowest element to ensure a response. And here's a song about just this. I don't often play tracks from Ray Davies' solo albums after the Kinks broke up, but here's one from the 2005 album Other People's Lives, and it's called, conveniently for us, Stand-Up Comic. Here's Ray Davies in full Cockney mode, taking on the role of the bawdy music hall comic, catering for the yabo tastes. I'm the lowest common denominator, and this is all about yob culture, he says. So welcome to jolly old England. I'm the stand-up comic. There's no more style, but just schoolboy humour. And the clown does a belch, and we all belch back, and that's that. Anyone with any culture is jeered at. If a well-spoken hero from yesteryear walks onto a stage, they all shout queer, and that's that. It's an odd song, not really a song in some sense. But here, see what you think. Attend. Oh, and by the way, there's a naughty word, so tune out now if you expect to be offended.
Now, I don't mind if 50,000 yobos beat me up outside a football ground on a Saturday afternoon. I'll still come out fighting. Do you know why? You've seen me on television. I'm the lowest common denominator. And this is all about yob culture. So welcome to jolly old England. I'm the
And the followers of stars say it's the latest thing. And William Shakespeare is the schmooze of the week. And anyone who says different is a fucking antique. And Noel Coward has become very hard. And the comic says bollocks and everyone laughs. And that's that. Style, I mean. Never was much, never has been. But the little bit that was all that we had. And the clown does a belch and we all belch back. And that's that. Jack the Lad has become Fancy Dan and creating agriculture with a rub on tan. On all the tearaways have got South Affair and a working class hero's got a tinted hair. And a well-spoken hero from a yesteryear walks out onto a stage and they all shout, queer! That's that. Manners, I mean. Never was much, never has been. But the little bit that was all that we had. Now the clown does a fart, we all fart back and that's that.
Okay, that was Ray Davis, stand-up comic. At the end, he tells them he's just going down to the pub after his show is over, minding my own business, being his true self, we may imagine. He invites them to join him, but I know you won't. You've all been watching too much television. That is, you've just been living the kind of passive life that sits back and lets someone else entertain you. Who cares about meeting the entertainers offstage? They're not funny, after all. What would I get out of it? I suppose the stand-up comic is an extreme example of the way we treat most people in our lives, but it's true, isn't it, that in ordinary circumstances, our interaction with other people is merely to get some benefit for ourselves. The person in the shop, we're just there to get the item we're shopping for, not to have a relationship with that person. The person on the other end of the phone when we're trying to resolve a problem with our electricity bill? We just want the problem solved, and there's no need to enter into a personal relationship here. Do you agree that this defines most of our interactions? We're just dealing with other people's acts or functions, not at all interested in the other people for who they are, for their true selves. But hey, maybe this shows us what might be lacking in our lives. Is it possible to look beyond the act to the person? And won't that, maybe, only maybe, won't that make our lives richer? I'll leave you with that thought while I take care of some business here. You're listening to Evening Under Lamplight with Robert Louis Abrahamson on Cambridge 105 Radio. We're attending now to the dynamics of interacting with other people's acts and functions, either just so we can get something for ourselves out of it, or so that we can actually be in touch with the true self of that other person. Stay tuned. We have lots more.
When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend Evening Under Lamplight. It's Cambridge 105 Radio.
Thank you, Neil Henry. So we're attending to the idea, or the habit, of looking beyond the act to the person behind the act. That means we don't judge the person by the act, by the external appearances. This isn't easy. Our minds are always trying to judge others. This way we can pin them down, and usually we can feel some sort of comfort to our ego. Oh, look at the way she's dressed, we might say, and then dismiss her. We meet someone at a party, and what do you do, we ask, as though what the person does will help us connect to the person. No, I suspect we ask what they do so we can judge whether they are someone we should play up to if they're rich and influential, or look down on if they do a job we can think less of. What I mean is that this habit of judging people by their exterior acts seems to be innate in us. Perhaps it's what the church meant by original sin, a flaw we're all born with that we're to spend our life trying to move beyond. So what's the alternative? In a way, what we want to do is to shut off the mind from its habit of making immediate and ego-centered judgments on what it sees, on the act or performance. There's always time to make judgments later, if we have to. But first, let's just try to look, just to open up to what's going on and letting that work upon us, even if it's not to our taste. Look at her with that tattoo all down her arm. It's so ugly, and what's she going to look like in 20 years' time? No, that's not going to get you anywhere, except for the brief pleasure of putting down someone else, showing how much better you with your bare arms are than she is. Instead, let's try just accepting those tattoos. After all, they are there, and there's nothing we are going to do about it. So once we accept the tattoos and look at them, maybe then we'll find some beauty in them, or perhaps we'll find ourselves moved by a kind of sorrowful compassion for this person who felt she had to put a cartoon frog on her upper arm. But whatever, we have had a response, not a judgment. And in that response comes the hope of some connection to some part of her true self. Or, of course, not necessarily her. Guys have tattoos also. And again, for all sorts of reasons. Let's pause for some boys trying to prove themselves men. Their old man didn't like our appearance. He said that only women wear long hair. See, he's got it all figured out with his judgments. But he's alienated his kids. So what next? Well, me and my brother borrowed money from mother. We knew what we had to do. We went downstairs, crossed the barber and gymnasium, and got our arms tattooed. Welcome to my life, tattoo. I'm a man now, thanks to you. You know the song? By The Who?
Talking to each other about what makes a man a man. Was it brain or brawn or the month you were born? We just couldn't understand. Our old man didn't like our appearance. He said that only women wear long hair. So me and my brother from mother, we knew what we had to do. We went downstairs past the barber and gymnasium and got our arms tattooed. I expect I'll regret you, but the skin rock man won't get you. You'll be there when I die. Tattoo. My dad beat me 'cause my stepmother, but my mother naturally liked it and beat my brother, 'cause his tattoo was of a lady in the nude, and my mother thought that was extremely rude.
Welcome to my life, tattoo. We've a long time together, me and you.
I expect I'll regret you, but the skin drop man won't get you. Now I'm older, I'm tattooed all over. My wife is tattooed too. A rooty doo too, rooty tooty too, too, rooty tootle too, tattooed too.
Go to the church of your choice. Of course, this is not Radio London reminding you to go to the church of your choice. That was just one of The Who's gags on their album, The Who Sell Out. That guy got his tattoo for egocentric reasons, as he admits. He's trying to prove himself a man, trying to show his father, though his father beats him because his tattoo says mother. We're not really going to move to his true self through his act of false manhood. But let's take another example. We're afraid of putting our judging mind aside and just open our heart, because then we're vulnerable. We've surrendered control. But the control isolates us from others, and we'll never make a connection. It's a commonplace to say that we connect through the heart, but it's nonetheless true. But such connections usually just come briefly, often just in a flash. But it's a flash that is deep and carries the conviction of its own truth. We cannot control this, and we cannot attain it by any conscious or conscientious act of our own. It comes to us like grace. Our task is to be open to it. In fact, our obligation is to be attentive, to attend to what's before us. To attend is not some kind of passive just showing up. The root of the word shows us that we must do something. I just said that our task is to be open, but there's more. The Latin root tendere means to stretch. The ad or at the beginning implies that we're stretching towards something, in a kind of relaxed eagerness, or at least a readiness to be shown something. And this is perhaps what I had in mind when I came up with the motto for Evening Under Lamplight: you are invited to attend. This isn't going to be a radio show where you can just sit back and nod your head at some good music or entertaining chat, but you're invited to stretch yourself to see what may lie behind the songs and the words we offer you here. In fact, though perhaps I shouldn't say this, it's not really the content of the show that is important. That's just the act, there for you to enjoy, of course, the medium through which my self reaches out to yourself, stretching to attend. And what is passing between us through the medium is what is technically called the spirit. My spirit infusing the spirit of the show, and then, I hope, resonating with your spirit. The spirit is the life, and it is the spirit that we seek in our relationship with other people and even with events. Often we go to a talk or watch a film or spend an evening with a friend. Often we we cannot remember anything specific about what was said, but we're full of the spirit of the person or the event. Many people have said to me that they really enjoy Evening Under Lamplight, thank you for that, but they can't remember what I was talking about. Nevertheless, there was a something, a je ne sais quoi, that moved them or opened up things for them. Or to put it another way, what we really want is not information or teaching, but a deeper insight, or what in India is called darshan. People come and just sit in the presence of their guru or some other wise person, not primarily to receive specific teachings, but just to be in the presence and to absorb the spirit of holiness emanating from the holy person. To move to another tradition, Saint Francis of Assisi told his followers always to preach the gospel everywhere, and if it was absolutely necessary, to use words. That is, they were to preach through the Spirit, which was manifested in the way they were living, and those who were open and could resonate with their spirit would get the message. And that reminds me also of what Hermes said to his father Zeus when Zeus, the king of the gods, asked him to be his special messenger to human beings. But wait, said Zeus, no offense, but my dear Hermes, you are a notorious liar. Can I trust you to get the message across? And Hermes answered, whether I tell them the truth or tell them a lie, they'll get the message. The exact words Hermes uses in his message aren't that important. It's the spirit behind the message that counts, and often deep messages are couched in ambiguous or vague language to force us to give up trying to understand the meaning of the words and instead to be open to the spirit behind the words. Or again, with our lover. It's not the words that matter, but something behind the words. You know you've made a connection when your lover speaks like silence, without ideals or violence. She doesn't have to say she's faithful, but she's true, like ice, like fire. Instead of carrying roses and making promises by the hour, my love enacts it and laughs like the flowers and doesn't buy the hype of phony words on Valentine's Day cards. Everybody else, in the dime stores and bus stations, for instance, is talking about things, repeating quotations as if that will carry the authority. They're drawing conclusions on the wall, no less. But my love knows too much to argue or to judge. And as a result, she's like a raven, a messenger of the spirit, but a raven with a broken wing, because, of course, being all these things, she is vulnerable and broken, and all the more precious and meaningful.
My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals or violence. She doesn't have to say she's faithful, yet she's true like ice, like fire. People carry roses and make promises by the hours. My love, she laughs like the flowers. Valentines can't buy her. In the dime stores and bus stations, people talk of situations, read books, repeat quotations, draw conclusions on the wall. Some speak of the future, my love, she speaks softly. She knows there's no success like failure, and that failure's no success at all. The cloak and dagger dangles, madams light the candles, in ceremonies of the horsemen, even the pawn must hold a grudge. Statues made of matchsticks, crumble into one another. My love winks, she does not bother. She knows too much to argue or to judge. Midnight trembles, the country doctor rambles, bankers' nieces seek perfection, expecting all the gifts that wise men bring. The wind howls like a hammer, the night goes raining. My love, she's like some raven at my window with a broken wing.
Bob Dylan, Love Minus Zero, No Limit. Has this entire show been worthwhile just for having opened up for us this song? And notice, by the way, that we don't really have to understand the words to catch the spirit of the song, though catching the words, playing with them, can certainly enhance our relationship with it. And we may want to ask, are we, through the act of the song, in touch with the true self of Bob Dylan? That's always been the question. All I can say right now is that we are in touch with something moving through his true spirit. Not his person, but something more ineffable, which we'd better not get entangled in trying to explain here. But there's one more way of talking about this I want to mention. Peter in Boulder was commenting about the previous episode of Evening Under Lamplight, and among other very nice things I'm too modest to repeat, he said that the show was, quote, very dance-like. Yes, he got it. That's what I often say myself after a show is finished. I danced with the show. But what is a dance? A dance is a movement, whether in the body or the imagination or the heart, between two or more people, with a third element as the music, that is, the thing they're dancing to. In the terms we've been using, the music can be the act you are putting on and I am responding to. My true self and your true self jiving together through your performance of that role you're playing. Even in seemingly trivial moments of life, I was exchanging thoughts the other day about this aspect of dancing with Mia from California. She picked up on this image of the dance and came back with an amazing example showing the awakened consciousness of her own being in the moment. Since we've been talking about this, she says, I've been thinking as I walk to work that my feet are dancing with the pavement and my scarf is dancing with the wind. And taking all of this a step towards the extreme, I see more and more a dance with the elements. Yes, wonderful. Mia could see that she, her true self, was not identified with the act, either of walking or wearing a scarf, but the movement of her feet and the flowing of the scarf were, in a sense, acts that she was putting on. You could imagine what might have happened if she had not been able to stand back and if she identified herself with the feet or the scarf. Why don't they fix the broken bits of this pavement? Why are they making me have to look down all the time so I don't trip? Or, hey, this wind is making my scarf blow out like some glamorous movie star. I hope that person over there notices this and likes me. All ego-driven, you see. But if she can stand back, and she can, then there's the delight. And she sees her feet and the pavement as coming together into relationship of a kind, the music being her walking. And she can be aware of the wind and thus be aware that there are natural forces beyond her own self and will not only feel the delight, but also surely become that much more respectful of the natural world that sustains all of us. Mia is a swimmer, and she spoke also of her dance with the water as she swims. This awareness won't make her speedier in the water, but it might make her even more elegant in her gestures as she swims, and more joyfully conscious of this relationship with the water that she has had for most of her life. Does this make sense? Well, it will make sense only if you can connect it to experiences of your own. I think I've given enough examples to help bring it to life. Now it's up to you. Attend to your own movements. Attend to whatever people or elements come to you and ask you for this dance. It happens every minute, after all. And now I think there's only one place we can go from here. Leonard Cohen's Dance Me to the End of Love. The lyrics are actually not that easy. First of all, whom is he speaking to? Who's going to dance him to the end of love? Is it some woman he's connecting with? Or perhaps it's the divine spirit who will be his dancing partner? Or both? In any case, Leonard moves through the song with a series of images of the dancing partner who seems to be the one leading the dance. But the fact that he doesn't say, lead me through these things, but rather dance me, is significant. The other may be leading the dance, but they're both in it together. They're both moving in harmony with the music, and the music, no doubt, is love, or capital L, love. There's an ambiguity here, too. What is the end of love? He could mean, if he's speaking to a woman who's his lover, that he wants to dance with her up until the inevitable dying of their love for each other, the end of their love. But there's a more important sense of end, the aim or the purpose. What is the purpose of love? And maybe the answer is just the dance. What is it that love desires from us? Just another dance. Either in the form of a chat with the postman, or with the tattoo on our arm, or love who speaks in silence, or the pavement and the wind. And there is only the dance, as T.S. Eliot said. Well, let me sign off before we move to the song, and here's the sign off. You've been listening to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson. Reach me at lamplight@cambridge105.co.uk and tell me about your experiences of dancing. I'll dance back with you.
Gathered safely, lift me like an olive branch, be my homeward dove, and dance me to the end of love. Yeah, dance me to the end of love. Let me see your beauty when the wind are gone. Let me feel your move.